We're going to take you on an incredible journey tonight here on Coast to Coast AM. A journey, of course, that even I am very excited to participate in. In a moment, our first guest will be Bill Ryan, and Bill will be with us for the entire program. Bill is the author of the website serpo.org, S-E-R-P-O.org. It's linked up right under his name at coasttocoastam.com. What you're about to hear will be a discussion about the possibility of an exchange program with extraterrestrials that occurred in 1965. Sometime this hour, at the halfway point, we'll be joined by none other than Whitley Strieber, who will offer his comments about this case as well. And then throughout the night, several other guests will be joining Bill as we talk about this incredible story on Coast to Coast AM. As I mentioned, Bill Ryan is the author of the website, www.serpo.org, S-E-R-P-O, trained in mathematics with physics and psychology, followed by a brief stint in teaching. Now, for the last 27 years, he's been a management consultant specializing in personnel and team development, leadership training, and executive coaching. He is not and never has been connected with a member of the military, government, or any formal UFO group. This information that he's sharing is in the spirit of what he calls the best place to hide is out in the open. He's our guest all night on Coast to Coast AM. Bill, welcome to the program. So good to talk with you.
George, thank you very much for inviting me on. I guess this is an interesting experience for me, listeners, because not only is this an extraordinary story, but you're being told it by an Englishman. So that's kind of doubly weird.
Well, let me tell you, I'm looking forward to it. But you've got to tell us all, Bill, how a person without a real formal knowledge of UFO groups, not a member of the military or the government, would get interested in the story we're going to talk about tonight.
That's a really good question. There's no problem with the interest. I think you'll find that among your millions of listeners, there are people who will be just as interested in all this as you or I are. I am part of a discussion group. It's an email forum. These email forums exist all over the world. People talk about music, they talk about cars, they talk about food, they talk about travel, and this particular one is devoted to the subject of UFOs, and there are many of those as well. This particular group, I think, has got some pedigree, let's say, because it contains a veritable who's who of everybody who's anyone in the ufological world. Many of the people on that list have so far chosen to remain anonymous for reasons which I really understand. But if you can think of just about any name in ufology that you can think of, those guys are going to be on this list. And so
I see, yeah.
It's quite an exclusive group. And we talk about stuff that comes up, and people come across documents, and people pose ideas to each other. And in the middle of all this, in the 2nd of November, just over a month ago, there was an anonymous posting that was moderated by the guy who runs the list. His name is Victor Martinez, who needs a big round of applause for everything that he's done here. He's down in L.A. And there was an anonymous posting that announced this extraordinary assertion of an exchange program way back in 1965 between our race and an alien race, which are known as the Ebens. This is our name for them.
And spell that, yeah. Spell
yeah, it's E-B-E-N. It's just an acronym for extraterrestrial biological entity, E-B-E-N.
Okay.
We don't know yet. From the postings, we're all dependent on the information that this anonymous source is presenting on the message board, and all I'm doing on the website is I'm just archiving all of these messages and making them available to a wider audience. So in a sense, I'm just a messenger here. And on the 2nd of November, this anonymous source started to tell this extraordinary story about this exchange between 12 American astronauts, 10 men and 2 women, in 1965, who spent 13 years on an alien planet 38 light years away, and 8 of whom returned to tell the tale in 1978.
What happened to the other 4?
2 of them apparently died. So we're told, and two of them decided to stay.
So we're told.
So we're told.
Okay.
All of this, I mean, I have to say, because I'm sure that even as we speak, thousands of your listeners may be reaching towards their phones because they want to ask for information about this. I'm happy to explain what I know, but there's a lot which I don't know. Everything I know is on the site. It's on the site, serpo.org. And there's a whole host of information that just isn't known yet, because this anonymous source, he's presenting his release in a graduated form. He's adding more information every few days. It's a bit like, you know, we're up to our 10th installment now, and the 11th should be out in a couple of days' time.
Well, this is an incredible story, Bill. Let me tell you why. Years ago, there was an individual by the name of John Titor who claimed to have been a time traveler from the future, and he began posting on the Internet some of his I don't want to call them predictions, because if you're a time traveler and you've already seen what happened, you're really not predicting. But he talks about some incredible things that have been going on this planet, and some of which are coming true now. No one knows where he is. He posted with his name, but we can't find him. He's gone. And if he is indeed a time traveler, who knows where he is. Now, in this particular case, this is brand new. As you said, it just happened in November, and it's being posted. Now, based on the types of information that is being posted by this anonymous person, do you have a pretty good feeling on what kind of person he is?
Oh, yes. There are some things which we know, and I also have a feeling for it. I'm happy to share that. First of all, I should explain that at first we thought, when I say we, this is the view, if you like, of the audience here in the front row, who were these 150 people, many of whom legitimately deserve the title of experts, in this moderated list. And we thought that this was just one source. Just in the last few days, it's been disclosed that, well, there are actually three sources. 85% come from one, 13% come from another, and then there's an intriguing 2% that comes and goes, and each time something is sent, a little snippet is sent on an email, then the email address is cancelled, and then that's the end of that email, which actually is a military trick. It's an automated device which tends to do that kind of thing. And so there are three sources. We know that they're, or we're told, let me say, that they are retired employees of the Defense Intelligence Agency, the DIA, and if one does a little bit of math on your fingers and toes, you realize that these guys are probably reasonably senior, let us say. They're probably in their 70s, because if they were involved at some kind of a capacity in this program in the 1960s, then that puts them maybe around about 70, 75, possibly a year or two older right now.
They seem very well connected, Bill. They seem very intelligent in their postings.
Well, they certainly sound as if they know what they're talking about. And the interesting thing about this to me, I mean, there are a whole bunch of interesting things, and I know that on this show we've got time to go into it. There are a lot of things that don't make sense. There are a lot of things that do make sense. They kind of triangulate against other known events, and there are some very subtle supporting factors that tend to lend credibility to the notion that this extraordinary idea is true. We do know, because on this list, not only are there well-known names in ufology, but there are also people with government connections, mm-hmm. retired CIA agents, you name it. We've got a lot of people on this list who do have contacts in high places and hidden places, let us say. And, of course, the first thing that all these guys did when these extraordinary assertions started to be published is they started to do their homework. And when they reported back on their homework, they found that rather than finding that there was no support for the story in these hidden corners, they came back and they found out that there was support for this story. And there are one or two extraordinary tales which I can tell about this. Now may not be the time, but I mean, now at this stage in the program might not be the time, but generally speaking, the investigators in the list, and these are people with a lot of experience, they're people who've written books, they're people who've appeared many times on shows like this, they're people whose reputation depends on their doing good work, they have come back and they say, listen, you know, this sounds crazy, but we think that there's something to this. There's some fire behind all this smoke, and we need to take this story seriously.
Absolutely staggering, Bill. So let's talk a little bit then about this episode. And I guess we need to even go back to the Roswell case, don't we?
That's when it's generally accepted that that's when this all started. When I say this, we're talking about the phenomenon of extraterrestrial visitation. For millions of people out there, this is still regarded as a fantasy, a bit of a Hollywood fairy story. Among the serious researchers, this is established very much as, it's agreed very much as established fact. There's such a huge amount of corroborating evidence for it that that's kind of the starting point for the whole labyrinth. It all kind of, it's like, that's actually the simple bit. After that, it starts getting complicated. And the reason why I'm mentioning Roswell as being the kind of agreed upon start for this is that there are assertions that there were earlier recoveries of crashed discs, I think in the early 40s. I'm not a UFO researcher myself. This is just from my memory. In 41, 42, some people say that there were some discs that were recovered as early as then. But Roswell's when the you-know-what started to hit the fan. And the story, as best as I know it, and once again, I'm a messenger rather than a researcher, is that, and while there are complexities about the Roswell case, once again, I'll try and keep it simple. There were ostensibly five recovered bodies and one live recovered alien, one live alien who was known by the moniker EBE-1, EBE standing for extraterrestrial biological entity. And this guy then became the world's first extraterrestrial visitor. He was held in conditions of deep secrecy, deep security, and while they figured out how to communicate with him, they tried to figure out what he was there for, what they were there for, what was going on, was the world in danger. And given that this was the end of the years after the Second World War and the beginning of the Cold War, this was at a time of tremendous national caution, let me say. And it's very, very understandable that the powers that be at that time decided to lock this whole thing away in a big kind of vault of secrecy until they figured out what was going on, whether there was a threat, and when, how, and whether to tell the world about it. And during all this time, they were figuring out how to communicate with this character, EBE-1, and the story goes that he survived until 1952 when he died of unknown causes. They couldn't save him from dying.
Okay, between that point then, 52 and 65, there must have been some other contact, Bill, for all this to come about.
One would think so. There are a lot of unanswered questions about this. The story that is told by Anonymous, as best as I recall it, there are some 13,000 words of information on the website. I don't know it all off by heart. But EBE-1 apparently had a communication device with him. And he was one of these Ebens, let us call them. This is our name for them, not their name for themselves. We don't know what that is yet. And they had a communication device. And we figured out how to use it, or he taught us how to use it. And he sent some messages home saying, you know, I'm okay, guys, come and pick me up sometime. And although actually this never happened because he did die in our captivity. But the story goes that during that time, this ostensible future exchange was set up and agreed with this alien race. And for reasons which personally I don't fully understand, there was quite a long gap of time between that and the time when the next thing happened. And that's why your question a few moments ago is a good one. In what happens next, I guess, is the next cornerstone of commonly accepted ufological lore, if you like, which is that in April 1964, there was a landing that was expected and planned, and I think there were a couple of discs, once again from memory. The ufological lore says that these guys landed at Holloman Air Force Base, which is near Alamogordo in New Mexico. Our anonymous source says actually that that's not quite right, that they were actually west of Holloman. I'm reading here from my notes, near the southern entrance to White Sands Army Post.
Right.
These are fine details which we'll find on the website, and if any of your listeners are serious researchers, they might find these details quite interesting.
Now, Bill, as this is going to evolve tonight, of course, we're going to talk about where they may have gone, these military personnel, this planet that, of course, your website is named after. This involvement, this gap again between when the alien passed on in 52 to 1965, when these 12 military people apparently trained and decided to move on in this program. Do we know anything about high-level government intervention, the president at the time, or anything like that?
I really don't know. At the moment, this hasn't been part of the information that our anonymous source or anonymous sources have revealed. It's worth stating as an overview that we are told by these anonymous sources that they're basically taking their information from a 3,000-page classified report. Now, that's a hell of a document. And if you do a simple word count, we're talking about maybe 500,000, 750,000 words. This is a huge, huge document. We've had about 2% of that so far that's been released to us in little dribs and drabs. And there's an awful lot we don't know, but there's still 98% to come. Now, I'm not asserting there that we're going to get all 3,000 pages of it, but there's still a lot of information to come. Our anonymous source is responding to questions gradually, but it's also clear that he and his colleagues, we know that another thing I didn't mention just now is we know that he's operating as a little group of six of them, these six retired employees from the DIA there. They're working together as a group, and these three sources who have been posting to the site, but mostly one person, they're the kind of spokespeople of that behind-the-scenes group. This is all coming from the DIA, from the Defense Intelligence Agency. And they're working to some kind of a plan. It would seem apparent they're working to a release plan. Otherwise, one could legitimately ask the question, well, why don't they just take as much information as possible and just dump it in the public domain, you know, knock on the door of the New York Times offices and say, well, here you are. Now, it's not being done like that. It's being done, first of all, through this fairly specialized group, and one can surmise about the reasons for that, but it's likely to have been to test the temperature before they go any further.
All right, Bill, you stay with us. I'm going to bring in Whitley Strieber in just a moment because I want Whitley to become part of this with you, this discussion, for the remaining portion of this hour. We'll be back in a moment with this story, again, this strange story that apparently in 1965, some kind of an exchange program between us and extraterrestrials where we carefully selected 12 military personnel, 10 men, 2 women, trained them, and off they went to another planet. 8 came back. 4 died there. We'll be back in a moment. Well, of the 8 astronauts who returned to planet Earth, all now have died. The last survivor died in 2002. We're going to bring Whitley Strieber in just a second to chat with Bill Ryan as we continue this interview with this incredible story that apparently happened in 1965, carried on through 78, where we carefully selected 12 military personnel, 10 men, 2 women, who went to another planet. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast 8. And Bill Ryan with us now is, of course, best-selling author of a number of books, including The Coming Global Superstorm that he wrote with Art Bell, that was turned into a movie. Many of Whitley Strieber's books have been turned into movies. Best-selling book, The Wolfen, The Hunger, and, of course, Communion. Whitley is with us now. He also has the internet-based radio show Dreamland that you can hear on his website, unknowncountry.com, Whitley Strieber. Whitley, welcome back to Coast to Coast. How are you?
Well, it's great to be back, George. It's been much too long since the two of us talked together.
My pleasure.
I'm very glad to be back. I incidentally have another book coming out in August called The Grays and a movie based on that book from Sony coming out about a year later. So you'll be hearing more from me in the future. But right now, let's talk about Serpo. I've been listening to the discussion, and I have a couple of things to add.
Okay.
The first one is this. The reason I became interested in this is as follows. In the early 90s, I was at a UFO convention, I believe in Gulf Breeze, Florida, and an elderly gentleman walked up to me and said that he had been to another planet and he could prove it. And frankly, I thought, oh boy, you know, another one. Whereupon he leaned close to my forehead and he either threw his voice or did something. And he said the words, what I thought was the word Serpico.
Uh-huh.
And I said, Serpico? You mean Frank Serpico, the cop? Referring to a famous police officer of the late 60s who would movie had been made about in the 70s, a whistleblower, interestingly enough, in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy, the old guy, just laughed and walked away. End of story until last week. When someone wrote a note to my website about this new thing, Project Serpo, and I was stunned to find that it had to do with people visiting another planet. It was called Project Serpo, so close to Serpico that that's what the guy could have said. And yet, at the same time, Serpico was also a whistleblower like Anonymous on the Serpo website. It was really very weird.
And it's funny you say that, Whitley, because when I knew Bill was going to be on the program tonight and I saw his website and the planet he was talking about, that's the first thing I thought of was Serpico and that movie and that informant. Same thing.
Right. Well, there it is. Now, with regard to the website, which I've read carefully, there's a gauntlet kind of thrown down here. There is mention of, for example, quote, 60 jam-packed pages of calculations from Dr. Carl Sagan. There's mention of the fact that Anonymous is in possession of a large amount of documentation. It's time that that documentation start to appear and that originals be placed under analysis so that this can be verified.
Absolutely.
That said... This is a story I have been hearing from sort of semi-insiders for years, and so has Linda Howe. Linda Howe knows a lot about this as well. It has been one of those kind of back burner things that you hear about and you think, oh, boy, who knows if that ever happened. And now suddenly here it is.
See, you have been, Whitley, of course, as we followed your history and your career through some incredible stories. And you, I think, better than any of us, could ascertain the possibilities of whether a story like this could or could not be true. Of course, as you just said, you have to have the documentation. We have to have more information. But is something like this, Whitley, possible that 12 astronauts from this planet would take off in an exchange program and go to another planet?
Well, one thinks it might be possible in the future. Whether it was possible in the past or not, I don't know. I can tell you a few things about what it's like in a close encounter situation. Among other things, one of the things that used to happen when we would have groups of people at our cabin in upstate New York years ago and the visitors would show up, if anyone was even so much as touched by one of them, which happened from time to time,
mm-hmm.
there would be a big time allergic reaction. The person would be having heavy allergies immediately and into the next day, to the point where in a couple of cases I was worried about maybe having to take someone to the hospital. I specifically refer to a woman who has talked publicly about this called Raven Dana, who had a very strong allergic reaction. So if you think that's what happens in a face-to-face confrontation, just in a normal situation, whether or not we could even live on another planet under those circumstances, I just don't know.
Would these ETs, Whitley, that we're talking about in this exchange program, would they be the same ones involved in your particular situation that led you, of course, to write your story through the book Communion?
Well,
same kind?
There's no way to answer that except to say that the description of them, the physical description of them on the website, does fit the physical description of some of the ones that I saw and that others saw at my house. So possibly, yeah, it would be possible. I can't tell you, I can't evaluate it in a kind of a final sense. There's always points of missing data. Like, for example, there's nothing on the website that tells the distance between the two stars or their mass. Therefore, it's impossible to calculate an orbit. And the website seems to dance around that by saying that the orbit of the planet didn't conform to Kepler's law. It violated Kepler's law. And it seems strange that there are certain things about it that are very odd. Let me put it that way.
You know, of the 100-plus...
It needs to be explained.
Of the 100-some planets that astronomers have found throughout this galaxy so far, I'm thinking, okay, did I miss one? Was there one called Serpo? Does it truly exist? And I can't find anything like that, Whitley. Can you? I mean, is there a real planet somewhere?
There isn't one. Interestingly enough, though, in Science Magazine in 2001, I think an issue... maybe it was issue 293 or 294, there was a brief discussion of the fact that multiple star systems with massive planets in orbit around the stars might actually be more prone to generating Earth-like planets than single star systems like our own. And that they might be able to sustain much tighter orbits than ours. And there was an effort discussed, which apparently never went anywhere, to try to see if they could look at some of these systems, multiple star systems with large massive planets like Jupiter, and see if they could detect Earth-like planets in them. Interestingly enough, on the Serpo website, they make a specific point of saying that this star system has no planets surrounding it, like no massive planets around it. Now, if we didn't have Jupiter, we would not exist.
Good point.
At all, because we would have been destroyed long since by prowling asteroids. Jupiter absorbs an awful lot of punishment that would get into the inner solar system if it wasn't there.
It's our buffer, and you're right. Without it, we would not be around. The fact that this individual is posting anonymously, on one hand, I can understand why. On the other hand, it makes you wonder, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, it always does. And I'm always open to this because, gosh, I was just talking a few minutes ago about apparent aliens showing up at my house. So, I mean, how can I be somebody who can be suspicious? But I think that everyone needs to always be careful and keep an open mind. Even, I mean, in my case, the truth is, in spite of what has happened in my life, I don't actually even know what the visitors are, ultimately. I don't know the answer to the question, just that they are really very strange. And in this particular case, it could be that this happened. I mean, I will admit to a peculiar experience in the late 80s that seems related to it. I will admit to having been told by people with enough authority to have a certain amount of inside knowledge years ago that something like this happened, that an exchange did take place, but never that anybody came back alive. That was a surprise.
Well, and it's pretty darn close to the ending of the movie, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, when a group of military personnel got on their spaceship and took off.
Well, it is close, and one then has to ask the question, is it because Steven Spielberg heard the same story I heard and made a movie out of it, or is it because, or is it close because the authors, Mr. Anonymous, watched the movie?
Exactly. It's one or the other, I think, no doubt. Woodley, I want to thank you for being on the program. Your insight is very valuable to us. I'm sure we'll talk with you when the book, The Grays, comes out. And quickly, how is Anne doing?
Anne is fabulous, and thank you for asking. She is very involved in editing unknowncountry.com. She's got Anne's diary up on the website, which is a great resource for anyone who's interested, and she's just doing great.
Well, great. Sounds like all our prayers were answered, and
I'm so glad. I think that's the explanation, because we went far, far down a dark road, and somehow or another got back.
Excellent. Woodley, we'll be talking to you soon again. Thank you.
Thanks, George.
Woodley Strieber, his website, unknowncountry.com, and he is one of the best in the business, let me tell you, and has some just incredible insight into what we're talking about tonight. Bill, let's go back to you for a moment, because we are, throughout this evening, going to go on just the tremendous assumption that this has happened and try to unfold this as best we can. Now, you say Anonymous continues to post on the Internet site, Bill?
He continues to post. There have been 10 major sways of information that he's deposited on the list. They've all been copied faithfully to the website. Everything is there. Nothing's been omitted. I haven't even altered any of the spelling or the punctuation. It's all exactly as originally presented. And I understand that there's going to be an 11th posting that's going to turn up maybe tomorrow, maybe the day after that. I hope before the end of the week. We're not certain. We never quite know what's going to happen. They're not at regular intervals. They're just every few days. And certainly any of your listeners now, they've got plenty to read right now if they go to the website and take
a
look.
It's like a book in a journal itself.
It really is. It's getting, you know, there are 13,000 words, and there's no sign that this is going to stop. And my own commitment here is to allow this process to continue. There's nothing we can do to to control it, to accelerate it, to manage it. It's not our place to do that. I'm appreciative that it's happening. I feel privileged to be a conduit to this process. I want to facilitate its continuance. I want to encourage everyone who's reading this information, who's listening to the show now, just exactly as Whitley said, just to suspend their disbelief. We haven't had a fraction of the information that we're told is available yet. There are some holes in it, exactly as Whitley described. There are some there's data that it would be useful to know to further evaluate, for instance, some of the orbital calculations against the physical laws that we believe we understand. That's caused a minor firestorm of interest among the scientists and astrophysicists on the original list, because they got to they got out all their Kepler's laws calculations and realized that there's something here that doesn't quite add up, but we don't know why.
Now, Bill, from the point though when the 12 left this country in 1965, this planet, and the eight came back in 78. Was there any communication with them? I mean, did we have any way to find out what was going on over that 13-plus year span?
That's a very good question. The honest answer to that is I don't know right now as you're asking me the question. I've got a vague memory, if you will forgive me being a little vague, that there is something about this on the site. I don't have all the information at my fingertips. I have to honestly say that I can't remember the answer to that question, and I don't know.
Okay. Now, when the eight came back, did they describe what this planet Serpo looked like, what was going on, the structures, the buildings, the inhabitants?
Yes, they did. They described a society that is fascinating. It's alien, as one could imagine, and it's an Earth-sized planet. The population of the planet is small by the standards of what we would expect. The anonymous source describes it as being 650,000, which is really pretty tiny. The population of our planet is some thousand times larger than that.
Wow, so we're 6 billion. You're right.
Absolutely. So we're talking about a very small population. They're very technologically advanced, needless to say. Everything that they require is provided for them. There's no money. There's a 43-hour day with assigned rest periods and work periods. We're given to understand that there are two suns in the sky, because this is what's astronomically known as a close binary,
mm-hmm.
meaning that these two suns are pretty close together rather than being very distant. And this is another thing that's upset our astrophysicists, because this the star system, which this is supposedly all about, which Serpo orbits in some sense, it's Zeta Reticuli. Our astronomers say that this is a distant binary, meaning that the suns, the two stars, are maybe a tenth of a light year apart. And our anonymous source states that that's not the case, that it's actually a close binary. And so you've got two suns in the sky. We can talk more about the astrophysical anomalies later and the possible explanations for that. And what, in my view, is some of the significance of that.
Isn't that incredible, though? The entire planet, 650,000 inhabitants, that's it.
It's a really tiny number. I mean, it would be very good for our planet if we were that small as well, because the...
Now you're starting to sound like the Illuminati. You know, they want to do that to us.
I get what you're saying. They wouldn't have quite such an impact on the ecology. 650,000 sounds like a small number. I really do agree. The history, apparently, of their species, of their race, is that they had some kind of a horrific war with another race of aliens. We're not told who they were. We're told that the Ebens, although they're ostensibly peaceful people, they destroyed the other planet, but they suffered tremendous losses themselves. And this war apparently lasted for 100 years, 100 of our years, I guess this would be. And
well, what was their lifespan? Did our personnel talk about that?
No. I don't believe so. I don't think we know their lifespan. We don't know that much about their physiology. We know that they eat vegetables, I believe. They play some strange games. They listen to strange music that sounds a little bit like Tibetan chanting, Tibetan intonations. They seem to like that kind of thing. They're very much into dancing.
Dancing?
Dancing. They dance in sort of very peculiar ways. This is an inherent part of their culture, we're given to understand.
All right, well, stay with us, Bill. We're at the top of the hour. When we come back, we'll continue talking about the planet Serpo. And also, let's talk about the craft that our personnel apparently left in. And the propulsion system. Let's see if they talked about that. We will also be bringing in soon Richard Doty. He's a retired U.S. military intelligence officer, spending 20 years in the U.S. Air Force working in counterintelligence. We'll get his twist on all of this when we come back. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. By the way, there is a picture of what one of these aliens in this exchange program might look like on the cover of the December issue of the UFO magazine, so you might want to be able to pick that up. It is at most bookstands, by the way. UFO magazine does a good job on all the latest in this area that we have been talking about. Bill, before we bring in Richard Doty, let me ask you a few more questions. Did they ever describe, as it posted on the website, what the ship, the craft, looked like that took our 12 military personnel back to their planet?
It's a wonderful question. It's exactly what a lot of people want to know. We haven't had that information yet. We're hopeful that that's going to come soon. It's certainly something that our anonymous source is aware that there are a lot of questions asked about that. The physicists want to know about the propulsion system. They want to know about how it is that a craft could travel 38 light years in 9 months, I think it was, which is a pretty good multiple of the speed of light. And at the moment, there are no details of of that kind of information which is posted on the site. So we're still waiting for that one.
Can you imagine somewhere, someplace, somebody has pictures of this craft, of it taking off, of our personnel getting aboard, and it's got to be priceless.
It's got to be priceless. We're hopeful, again, that our anonymous source might at some point be able to or see fit to post some photographs to the site. It may be a long shot, but as Whitley was saying, what would be helpful at this stage for their own release plan would be to provide the kind of hard information that people can really start to focus on, information about the physics of the craft, photographs to look at, documents to analyze. But at the moment, we only have a hazy idea of what constraints they're working to. We don't really know what access they have to this document. I don't think it's, you know, lying around on their coffee tables in their front room. This thing's got to be kept under lock and key, and somehow it seems like they've got access to it, but we don't know how, we don't know under what circumstances, we don't know whether they're able to scan photographs or extract copies of printed pages so that people can look and see the typeface of the typewriter and all this kind of stuff. There's so much we don't know. We don't know what they're able to provide us with. But these are smart guys, and they know that it's in the interests of their credibility to provide us with as much information as they can to satisfy all the public questions here that are being asked.
Absolutely. Stay with us, Bill Ryan, and we'll be back with Richard Doty as well on Coast to Coast AM. Richard Doty is a retired U.S. military intelligence officer. He spent 20 years in the U.S. Air Force working in counterintelligence. During his counterintelligence days, he was briefed into the U.S. program, which investigated UFOs and extraterrestrial contact. And during this time period, he read a document that summarized an exchange program between the U.S. and an extraterrestrial race. He's now a private citizen living in New Mexico and is a private researcher of a wide variety of things, including UFOs and historical events in New Mexico, including ghost towns, Roswell, remote locations of paranormal activity. Richard Doty. Hello, Richard. Welcome to Coast to Coast.
Good evening,
George. Good to have you with us. Richard, this document that you were able to see that summarized the exchange program between the U.S. and extraterrestrials, tell us a little bit about that, and how does it coincide with what's being posted now on this SERPO website?
Well, George, sometime during the early 1980s, I read a briefing document which pertained to the United States' involvement with the investigation of UFOs and extraterrestrials. In this briefing document, there was a brief summary of an exchange program involving 12 U.S. military personnel with an extraterrestrial race. The exchange program took place from 1965 to 1978. But that's about all that was mentioned in this document. It was just a brief summary of the exchange program, but it didn't provide any details of the exchange program, nor did it mention anything about any debriefings of the 12, or the 8, actually, when they returned.
Now, I know you probably don't know who the anonymous poster might be, but do you have any guesses?
I have a number of guesses. When this first all broke, I just became a member of that, the Victor Martinez's email list prior to that, and there were a number of people who were guessing, and they even guessed that it was me. But later on, Victor Martinez confirmed it wasn't me, and it was, and he knew the identity of this person. I've done a little bit of research. And I've talked to a number of my former colleagues, intelligence officer colleagues, and I kind of think I know who it is, but I don't want to mention the person's name. If it's who I think it is, that person is retired from one of the intelligence community agencies.
Why would he be posting now, Richard? What do you think?
You know, I don't know that. You know, at first when this came out, I was a skeptic. I thought, well, this isn't, you know, this isn't for real. I've never heard, I heard some bits and pieces of it over the years, and I've heard rumors, but nothing of this magnitude, nothing of any kind of details. And until it started flowing, and then I contacted my my former former colleagues, and they're telling me that they're hearing the same thing, and they're hearing rumors from within the intelligence community that this is in fact true. And so the more that is being released by this Mr. Anonymous, the more other people are coming out confirming it.
It is a very strange story, isn't it, Richard?
Yes, it is. It's very strange. And ironically, there are two people that are open, that have posted open, provided their names to the CERPA website, one being a Paul McGovern and the other one being a Gene Laskowski. And they are confirming basically what Victor is, what Mr. Anonymous is telling Victor, with exception of some discrepancies.
And what are those discrepancies?
Well, one of the discrepancies, and one thing that I had been told earlier was that there was 12 U.S. military personnel, and they were all men. But according to Mr. Anonymous, there were 10 military men and two women. I have a problem with that. I don't want to get a lot of feminists on my my tail right now, but back in the 19, if you consider. I think you were in the service, George.
Yes.
Yeah. Back in the 1960s, in the middle of the 60s, females weren't really prominent in the military. They were actually segregated. The Army had the WACs. The Air Force had the WAFs. The Navy had the WAVs. And most of the females were in medical, career field, or supply or administration. I just found it difficult to believe that they found two females, and number one, that they would send two females on such a trip, and secondly, that they would, you know, find qualified females to do this.
Unless it was like an Adam and Eve mission, you know.
That's true. It could have very well been. And there's been a lot of talk over this this email system about the reasons why they sent two females, and some reasoning is that. Well, listen, this is an exchange program, and this is a chance to exchange races, and we wanted the Evens to know, hey, we have females, and here's two. So, you know, that's very plausible.
You are a believer in extraterrestrials, because were you not present at an interview with an alien sometime in 83?
Well, not necessarily in that matter. I was not physically present, per se, but I witnessed a film, that, which was apparently made just a few days prior to me viewing it, which I was told that contained one extra biological entity, a codename EBA 2, and two interviewers. They were seated at a table, and I witnessed this film, which ran about 20-some minutes, and it was a question-and-answer period or a session between these two interviewers and this EBA 2. And in this interview, the EBA 2 was speaking English, but in a very, very harsh sounding voice, and it was almost difficult to understand the answers. But it was a question and answer period.
What did it look like? Was it like a gray?
Yeah, it was. It was. It looked like a classical gray, and with the big eyes and the small slit for the mouth, the two openings for the nose. The camera was directly on the face of the EBA 2, not necessarily on the body, but you could see the hands on the table, and you could see that they were very. It was very thin. The entity was very, very thin, but the facial features was that of looked like a gray to me.
Richard, address this. We're going to keep you, by the way, for the rest of the show
sure.
in next hour or two to take phone calls with Bill Ryan. And Bill, jump in anytime you want now, too. Let me ask you this, though, Richard. I want you to address this. Linda Moulton Howe, whom you know and we know,
yes.
She does some reports for us. She corroborates many of the things that you have said about the films and meeting you. But she believes, and I think she'll always believe, that for some reason – You were a counterintelligence guy who was out to not get her to get the full story and to hold her back from getting this thing public. And I just wanted to get your reaction to that.
Well, back in the early 80s, I did have contact with Linda Howell. We had a counterintelligence mission that involved trying to obtain what information she knew. And so everything that Linda basically says is factual. But I was doing my job then. But, you know, later on, Linda and I became, I guess I can say loosely friends. I shared information with her that was kind of off the cuff, and she shared information with me in the latter part of the middle 80s or so. And I have to say she's a great researcher, and she had her own sources, which really surprised me. And I didn't expect her to tell me things about this program, UFO program, that she did. And one of the things that we discussed sometime in the middle 80s was this exchange program. She actually had a name of somebody that had been involved, and she ran that name by me. And I didn't know that. I didn't know the information. But
did you know the name?
I didn't know the name. I didn't know the name. I didn't know anybody's name that was involved in this. But Linda knew, and I told Linda, well, I'll go and check on it. But you know, I never knew any names. So I was hoping she would come on tonight, this morning, so we could kind of throw this back and forth. But Linda is an excellent researcher, and I respect her fully. I know that I was a counterintelligence officer. I had a job to do back then, but I left that business in 1988, and I haven't been involved in it since, and I haven't worked for the government since, and I have no reason to disinform anyone since that time.
So I guess this would be a revelation for Linda at this point. If she were listening tonight, we tried to get a hold of her so you two could chat, and I guess she's unavailable. But this would be a revelation for her, and she would probably say, "I knew it. He was a counterintelligence guy."
Yeah, I think since that time we've talked. We met once. I think it was 1991 or 92 in Albuquerque. I think it was a UFO conference or something, and I just came up to her and said hi, Linda, and we talked for a short period of time, and I kind of apologized to her for some of the things that we had to do, but I don't know if she's ever forgiven me, but I was hoping that she would be on tonight so we could discuss in the future.
If we find her before we're off the air, we'll pop her on. If not, maybe another program, maybe even with the both of you.
Sure, that would be.
I think that would be fantastic. Did you become almost like a J. Allen Hynek, Richard, where in the beginning he was working for Project Blue Book and he was a skeptic and he decided, you know, these things did not exist? And then he changed. He changed so much. He became one of the nation's foremost authorities in the existence of extraterrestrials. Did that evolution happen for you?
Yes. Growing up, my father's retired military. And growing up, I grew up in a military household. I never had any interest whatsoever with UFOs. My brother did, but I never did. My brother used to read all the True magazines and all those older ones. He read George Adamski's book. I never had any interest. When I got into the intelligence arena, I don't know why, but I was briefed into this program. And I remember my briefing in 1979. I said to myself, this isn't real. This isn't for real. This must be just something science fiction. But, of course, as I became more intimately involved in it, I realized it is, in fact, true. Reading everything I read, seeing what I saw over the years, it made me a believer.
Let's bring in Bill Ryan to join the discussion. Now, Bill, the work you've done for Serpo.org, of course, the author of the website, and you know, these mysteries and these clues that keep coming in are truly fantastic. In your opinion, Bill Ryan, you've looked at all this. You've heard all these people come in and out. What do you think's going on?
Thank you. This is a $64,000 question. The history of my position about this, I guess, pretty much tracks Rick's, and there are good reasons for this. At first, I was fascinated, and then more data started pouring in, and I thought, now, come on a minute, you know, everything's got to follow Kepler's laws, and there are one or two things that don't add up here. And then I started communicating with individuals. I spoke to Rick, and everyone was talking to everyone else behind the scenes here. This created such a buzz of interest. And exactly as Rick has explained, the people who had the contacts among the deep insiders started to report back to their colleagues on the list. It's like, hey, hang on, guys, you know, we really need to suspend our disbelief here, because there's, you know, there are senior people in high places who are taking this seriously, and we're starting to get corroboration that there's something that really happened here. And for me, this is a story that I really would like to tell your listeners. There was a guy who was on the list. He's somebody who I'd spoken with about a number of matters, consulted him on his particular field of expertise. He doesn't want his name to be known, because I think he's a modest man. He comes over to me as being a man of integrity and thoroughness and intelligence and caution. And he is an Air Force lieutenant colonel who's assigned to the Pentagon. And he had a friend, an older friend, who, in fact, who is the father of somebody who he knows. And he went to this retired person who was a full colonel in the Air Force, who had spent 33 years in intelligence. This guy is an elderly man. He wasn't on email. And my correspondent printed out what he could of the postings from this anonymous source and produced them in front of this guy, this Air Force colonel with 33 years in intelligence, and sat and watched his reaction as this guy read through the information.
Mm-hmm.
And he watched his response very, very carefully. And when this guy was finished, he said, "Oh, my God, who on this earth would release such classified material?"
Oh, my.
And my correspondent then asked him if all this information was real, and his simple answer was, yes, it's all real. And it turned out, this is one of these extraordinary accidents that, in my own view, is highly significant. It turned out that this guy, who my correspondent had consulted purely because he happened to know his son, was involved in the Serpo project himself and had no idea that this was being disclosed, because the guy isn't even on email. And for me, this is a significant factor. And it's an example of the kind of corroboration that seems to be happening right now in all kinds of corridors and military installations back there. There are people who are, you know, who have been associated with the program, who know people who are associated with the program. It's probably the most highly classified project in all of American intelligence history.
It's an incredible story. Bill Ryan and Richard Doty, our guests, they'll be with us for the rest of tonight. Next hour, we're going to take your phone calls, and I'll be back with them in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And we are going to open up the phone lines for you next hour with Bill Ryan and Richard Doty and give you an opportunity to chat with them about this truly incredible story. Richard, do you know if U.S. presidents were apprised of the alien situation?
No, I don't have any firsthand knowledge of that. I've heard rumors that President Reagan was briefed, and Nixon, but I don't have any firsthand knowledge.
Now, your role primarily as a military intelligence officer when you were there, were you assigned primarily to, you know, handle the extraterrestrial situation, or were you doing a lot of other things?
Well, I was doing a lot of other things. It wasn't just that. I was involved in the whole realm of counterintelligence operations, not just UFOs, no.
Okay. Bill, let's talk a little bit about this episode again and the information that's posted on the Serpo.org website. were the astronauts who went to this planet, Serpo, were they supposed to conduct experiments, and why were they gone for so many years?
That's a great question as well. They were originally intended to go for 10 years, and one of the things that's intriguing about Anonymous's account is that they seem to have lost track of time. We're even told by Anonymous that in some way that's hard, I guess, hard for him to explain and hard for us to understand, he says that time seems to operate or run or flow in a different kind of way in that system, and that is in some way accountable for the fact that the physical laws that we recognize and understand don't work in quite the same way. Now, at this point, all we can do is just hope and wait for more information, because most people throw their hands in the air when they hear that kind of thing, because it's hard to work with it, it's hard to evaluate it, it's hard to know what to make of it. And as yet, we don't fully understand whether it simply means that time was doing something a bit weird, like it was flowing in different rates, like water flows down a river, sometimes fast, sometimes slow, whatever, or whether it was that they lost track of time because of the difficulties in calibrating whatever they were experiencing with Earth time. It seems that the latter is certainly true to some extent, whether the former was or not. For example, they took a large kind of clock with them that was, I mean, it's more than a clock. It's like a kind of calendar clock that was designed to keep them in pace with Earth time. And then we're told that this stopped and they ran out of batteries and they weren't able to get the thing going again. It sounds like a slightly comical bit of human error, but once again, this is it's actually a part of the story that for me, while at first I started thinking, well, this sounds like a bit of a tall tale, the more I thought about it, the more I thought that if this was science fiction, the writer of the science fiction would have done a better job of it than that. And my view started to turn around 180 degrees. This is linked to the question that you asked me just before the break of the evolution of my own position with this. I started off being a little skeptical about it, and now I'm pretty much right there. I really think that this is the real deal. For example, and I understand this is deviating a little bit from your question because you asked me about the duration that they were there, but there's a point here that I'd really like to make, sure, which is that you can go to your local bookstore and you can buy well-crafted science fiction stories that present credible, consistent worlds. And if you're a science fiction writer trying to present a convincing story, the first thing you do is you get a physics grad student and you check out your science to make sure that it works out and that your days and your years and your orbital distances and your orbital periods all kind of match up so that you're creating a consistent, believable world. They do this in Hollywood. They do this in the world of writing science fiction. And so rather than this being an anomaly that would lead us to discredit the account, for me, the fact that, for instance, some of the physics doesn't add up is for me a confirming factor. This is something which I really want your listeners to think about, that the obvious thing to do, the first thing to do, would have been to make sure that all the numbers worked. And the fact that the numbers are out and the anonymous source is clearly laying himself open to criticism and questioning, because it's like, you know, how come this doesn't fit the equations that we think we understand and can apply to planetary systems? The very fact that it doesn't fit, for me, is a confirming factor, because if this was a made-up story, then he would have made sure that it was all consistent. And for me, the fact that there are these oddities in the story are confirming to me that the story is true. And back to your original question about the these peculiarities about time. They were meant to have stayed out there for 10 years, and somehow they lost track of time. Or they lost track of calibration with Earth time, or something happened. They didn't come back after 10 years. They came back after 13 years. And there's a significant clue in there for me, because this is something that maybe some of your listeners have heard about. There have been some experiments which have been done in a field which is technically called chronobiology, which sounds like a fancy term. What it means is, what do our biological systems do when we're deprived of external objective means of knowing what the time is? And there's a French guy called Michel Siffre, S-I-F-F-R-E. The details are chronicled on a website under the page which is called Consistencies. And in 1972, this guy, Michel Siffre, who was a caver, in England we call him a caver, I guess you'd call him a spelunker over here, he volunteered to spend half a year underground with all the conveniences that he would need to have, he would wish to have. He had books, he had entertainment, he was all on his own, but he didn't know what time it was at any point. And all that he was required to do was to check off whenever he thought a day had gone past and to come out when he thought 180 days had gone past, half a year. Now, he stayed down there, and he came out after 205 days, thinking that half a year had gone past. This is very consistent with what happens with these guys who went off to Serpo ostensibly. Maybe they thought that 10 years had gone past, but actually they were there for 13.
That's true.
The significant thing for me as well is that this experiment with Siffre, it happened in 1972, and it was sponsored by NASA. And it's most interesting to just speculate on the possibility that, it's pure speculation, but once again, it's a corroboratory factor, and it comes from a peculiar direction, that if here on Earth, and I have checked, by the way, your previous question, which you asked about an hour ago, that they were in communication with these guys when they were away. Supposing they knew that they were losing track of time, the only experiment they could do to find out what people happened when they lost track of time is stick them down a cave with all mod cons and just wait to see what happened. And sure enough, time gets stretched. And this is exactly what happened with these guys.
All right, and the story adds, by the way, on the coasttocoastam.com website, we have a picture of the Betty Hill map, the star map of Zeta Reticuli, where these 12 military personnel apparently went to. Now, untold until now, Richard C. Hoagland, after a nine-hour meeting with Betty and Barney Hill, they were the ones who were abducted at their area there in New Hampshire. They're the first. Richard was the first to recommend to his colleague at the time, Dr. J. Allen Hynek, and that was in 1966, that Betty Hill be rehypnotized so she could draw that star map that you can see that led to Marjorie Fish's identification of Zeta Reticuli as the possible star of the aliens. Richard joins us now on Coast to Coast AM with Richard Doty and Bill Ryan. Richard, this is truly an incredible story. I know you've been listening to it for the last couple hours.
Not only that, I was given this website, Bill's website, a couple days ago, and I read carefully, word by word, all 13,000 words of Anonymous's contributions and then all the comments, and I submitted a set of comments of my own. I haven't received a response yet, nor have they been published, but I presume that'll happen in due course. The thing that's so intriguing to me here is what Bill identified a few moments ago. The physics should be consistent, and it's not. And to me, that says this could be real. It sounds paradoxical, but I agree totally with Bill that if somebody's going to make this up, if this is a disinformation thing from the DIA, and Art and I, years ago, had a very interesting run-in with a DIA agent who was actually trying to run a scam on us, and we exposed him on Coast to Coast. There's a bunch of programs, which if anybody ever taped those programs, they can go back and listen. It was a pretty interesting expose. The point is that you're always suspicious of these things that come from anonymous inside sources.
Sure.
But the thing that rang my chimes was when I went through this careful listing of all these reports, all 10 entries so far, and the thing that rings truest is what Bill said. The physics doesn't fit. It should fit if someone was going to make this up and want to be believed, so why doesn't it fit? And the answer is the weird physics correlates beautifully with the results of our hyperdimensional physics experiments and modeling we've done over the last 20 years, and almost nobody could know that, particularly down to the temporal discontinuities and the celestial mechanics problems having to do with Kepler's laws and Newton's laws, and the fact that the eight folks that came back, you know, George, they all died.
They all died.
Relatively quickly. They were relatively young, but they died. And the question then is, I mean, I've seen the speculations on Bill's site that it was radiation, and I don't think that's what it was at all. What I said in my contribution was, it's very possible and plausible that it was because when they went there, they all experienced, according to this anonymous, contributions, nausea, disorientation, medical problems. They all suffered very severely initially, like they were out of sync with their environment. Then they got well, and they acclimated. But when they came home, they died. And it's very much in the model of the different physics that their biology could not reacclimate to life here.
See, all this too, Richard and Bill, strangely coincides with what I've been told by a publisher of a major magazine. I can't reveal his name yet, that in the not-too-distant future, there will be some full disclosure, and he is working on getting them on Coast to Coast and in a publication simultaneously. And with this coming out on the website now, and so many things that have been leaking out, the former Canadian defense minister talking about the existence of aliens and UFOs, it's all coming down at the same time. This by itself is not coincidental, Richard.
I don't think so. Now, let me run another scenario. Suppose for a minute that Zeta Reticuli, the whole story, is merely what I call a carrier wave. What do I mean by that? It's a well-known story, Betty and Barney Hill, the map, the Zeta Reticulans, the Grays, everything Whitley was talking about the early part of the show. It's so well-known in ufology that you don't even have to draw a map. You say Zeta Reticuli, and everybody who's involved knows basically the parameters. So there's a given that people will kind of go for the story. But then you introduce this bizarre physics, the physics that doesn't fit. And that makes you want to say, it can't be real. But suppose the objective of whoever's doing this has nothing to do with UFOs or Zeta Reticuli per se, and has everything to do with what I think is important, which is the fact that physics, as mainstream science thinks they knows it, is wrong. Physics constants change. If we go to another planet, not the moon, because it's in the Earth's moon system, but if we go to Mars, the odds are that the physics we actually measure will be different. If we go to the outer solar system, even more different. If we go to another star system, very different. And that is so at odds with mainstream science that if that's what's going on, if this story is out there to get physicists to look seriously at experiments that will, on Earth, discover these discrepancies, I mean, if we had time, which, of course, we don't tonight, I have just tripped over a huge body of Russian literature on what's called torsion physics by some of their literally Nobel-caliber physicists, which is the continuation of Einstein's grand unified field theories of the 1920s. It predicts, under certain circumstances, that these experiences, as reported by this Mr. Anonymous on this site, could in fact occur. And that's why, George, I think we've got to stay on this and pursue it to the bitter end, because there could be an extraordinary story here for everyone.
I think so, too. And I think also extraordinary that you had chatted to Hynek about getting Betty Hill rehypnotized. Richard, when I was 21, a reporter in Detroit, I interviewed Dr. Simon out of Boston.
Benjamin Simon.
Yep, who is since dead. He talked all about this case. And I, since in all my many moves over the last 30-some years, I can't find my tape. And it was a classic. And I don't think there are many people who have him on tape anymore.
Oh, no.
I could have played it on Coast to Coast. It was wonderful interview by a 21-year-old reporter at the time. But, Richard, thank you. Enterprise.
About the same age.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you were always older.
George, this is Bill here. I just wondered if I could just chip in for 30 seconds.
Sure.
Richard Hoagland, I just wanted to let you know that I read your message very carefully. It deserved such a detailed reply that it's not the kind of thing I could rattle off in 5 minutes, and I've really been swamped.
Okay.
I've flagged it, and I've earmarked it. I want to take this up with you. It's going to go on the site, and I really thank you for your contribution. I look forward to a dialogue with you.
Well, I thank you for what you're doing, and by all means, keep doing it. This could be a breakthrough.
Okay. Let's hope so, Richard. Thank you very much.
Very good. We're going to keep Richard Doty and Bill Ryan with us next hour because we're going to open up the phone lines. And, of course, you just heard Richard C. Hoagland giving us his insight into this truly incredible story where apparently in 1965, 12 astronauts, military personnel, 10 men. Richard Doty, what do you think of this story in the posting? Did you expect it, something like this, to finally happen?
No, I didn't. I this surprised me when this was posted. I never expected somebody would come forth and with this information.
Are you glad they have?
Yes, absolutely. I think it's about time the story is told. I'm just interested to see what our government is going to do, what they're going to say regarding this.
And you, Bill Ryan, the website, of course, serpo.org. How long do you keep it going, until the story's told or beyond?
That's a wonderful question. It's like I started this little fire here, and I'm thinking, hey, hang on a minute, I can't go away and leave this thing. I've got to kind of keep tending it until something happens. And this may go on for quite a long time. I have absolutely no idea what timescale Anonymous and his colleagues are thinking of continuing this release program for. If we're 2% into a 3,000-page document and he's posting every few days, this could go on for months. Now, I welcome that because I'm the kind of guy who really enjoyed the Lord of the Rings films, and I'd wish that they made 10 more of them, you know. So I've got a ringside seat here, and I'm very happy with it. It's pretty time-consuming. I'll be very curious to know by the end of this evening how many messages I've got to answer.
Good luck.
So far, I've had a few dozen, and some of them, like Richard's, have been most thoughtful. I'm expecting now a few hundred or maybe even 1,000 or two.
I hope, Bill, you've done your Christmas shopping because you're not going to have time to do it now.
To tell you the truth, George, you know, this is the kind of problem I'm delighted to have. I know that I'm surrounded by a team of people here who'd be happy to help with the correspondence. I want to see everyone involved in this. We're starting to see this little team come together here. It's a virtual team. We don't know each other personally, but I had a long conversation with Rick this afternoon. We're delighted to get to know one another. I believe that there are ways of handling these problems, and it's the kind of problem I want to have, you know?
Okay, let's go to the phones because they're all lining up as well. We'll go east of the Rockies. You're on Coast to Coast. You can get us started. Hi there.
Hello.
Yeah, go ahead, sir.
Yes, my name is Paul. I live about 20 minutes from Gulf Breeze, Florida.
Okay, Paul.
And, by the way, good show. If this story is true, did the military personnel age normally after they came back? And does current administration know about it? And why don't they stop y'all from talking about it? They figure that, you know, nobody listens to a late-night show, and I'll listen offline.
Well, they haven't stopped you yet, and I don't think they're going to. Who wants to take that first? You, Bill? You, Richard?
Let me just comment on, the dilemma that the government has now is if the government comes forth right now and says, listen, we've had this stuff locked away and it's about time we tell the public what's going on and what we have locked away. Do you imagine the ramifications that would occur? Now, on the other hand, if Mr. Anonymous and his group holds a news conference and displays pictures or documents supporting this exchange, can you see the ramifications that would occur then?
Yeah, that's a good point.
So, as to why our government is allowing this, I think I was told, and maybe Bill will comment on this too. I was told that the government, the White House, is actually preparing or had prepared a response just in case a question is asked during a news conference with Scott McClellan. I think, Bill, you heard that too, I understand.
I've heard various rumors. I mean, I'm in no position to comment on this. I'm not sure if this is our place to speculate on this right now, but I appreciate Paul's question. This is one of the reasons why, as I said in my site, I choose to hide out in the open here, because I haven't got anything to be afraid of. If somebody comes to my door and puts a bullet through my head, then the world's going to know about it, and that'll be confirmation of the story, so they're not going to do that. I've got nothing to hide. I've got no links with intelligence communities anywhere in the world. And so I'm quite happy to come out with this stuff, and I don't think anyone's going to do anything about it. I would encourage anyone out there who has any information that they have. I mean, earlier on we were talking about what might the motivation be for retired government employees who for decades have been sworn to secrecy. They may be nearing the end of their lives now, bless them. And I can kind of imagine what it might be like thinking, well, okay, I've got a few years ahead of me now, and I'm sitting on one of the greatest secrets that it's ever been mankind's privileged not to know. And maybe I should just do the right thing and spill the beans, you know?
You're right, Bill. We have two major cases here where former Colonel Philip Corso, who has now died, released information when he was up in age, and then he died a short time after his book was published, the day after Roswell. We have the former Canadian Prime Minister, who's in his 80s, who has gone public for the first time. So you're absolutely right that these individuals, when they get to a certain age, I think they decide that, you know what, it's about time that they talk, and maybe they're doing it for their kids. Who knows? But I think that's what's beginning to happen with them.
I think they're doing it for their consciences. It's like just sitting, looking back on their lives with the satisfaction of their own integrity, knowing that they've done the right thing. And if there's anybody listening who is wondering, should I or should I not say something, I would encourage people to do the highest, greatest thing that they can. This is for mankind. This isn't just for a group that has an agenda or that may have vested interests that we can only guess at. This is something that's greater than that. It's greater than all of us. And if anybody wants to communicate with me, there are ways to do this through the contact form on the website. You don't have to give your own email address. You have to put in something, but just put in contact@sobo.org, and then that'll get through to me. And then there's information, and then we can pick it up, and then we can work with it. But if anybody knows anything, let's have it on the table. This seems to be the time. There's a lot of corroboratory indications that this is now it's a time where this is happening. So there seems to be a groundswell, a kind of movement. Maybe it's even caused by the fact that there are a lot of people who are involved in these programs back in the 60s and 70s, and maybe they are looking in the mirror, they are looking back at their lives, they are thinking, well, maybe I need to do something. This could be a contributory factor. Let's get it out in the open and let's have this moving.
What did the group eat on this planet, Serpo?
Okay. We're told that they don't eat meat. We're told that they eat vegetables. We're told that their digestive systems are very efficient, and they don't, I mean, this is one of these peculiar little details that to me kind of rings true, that they don't excrete very much. This was a kind of an interesting problem for the human team there, because in comparison with the Ebens, they excreted all the time, you know, like humans do. But the Ebens didn't really do that very much. And so special provisions had to be made for them. So we know that the Ebens had a very efficient digestion.
They'd be the perfect pets then, Bill.
That sounds like it.
What did our people eat up there?
They took 45 tons of equipment with them, so we're told, 90,000 pounds of equipment, including military sea rations, enough to last them for, I mean...
Not 13 years?
Well, no. Enough to... apparently their food lasted them for a couple of years, and then they managed to eke that out for another 8 months, to last for 2 years and 8 months. They didn't care for the Eban food at first. And then I guess they had a kind of Hobson's choice. It was either the Eban's food or the military sea rations, and then eventually they they weaned themselves over to the Eban's food. And clearly they survived pretty well on that for the rest of the time.
Let's go to our wild card line. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hello, George. This is Scott Tucker. I'm in Plainview, Texas. I had a comment and a question. I had a comment for you about Monday night or Sunday night show about the Iran nuclear thing with Israel. Interesting show.
Okay, thanks. Go ahead. Go ahead with your question, though.
My question is for these guys, if this is so top secret, why aren't these people ending up dead? I mean, very suspiciously, because that would be what the highest levels of security people getting leaked out like that. I would think they'd end up dead. It's not that, because I believe in aliens. It's just that I would think they would want to keep this covered up.
Let's let you answer that, Richard Doty, because you've got the military background.
Well, I tell you what, in all my years in intelligence, and I worked in both counterintelligence, counterespionage, meaning we worked agents against the Soviet Union, I never heard of a agent being killed by us. I've never heard of any type of a black operation team that went around killing people. There were some cases back in the early 50s, but they just don't do that. The intelligence community, the U.S. government just doesn't do that. We don't go around killing our own people, quiet them up. There's other ways to do it. I mean, the threat of prosecution for espionage or unauthorized disclosure of classified information or something like that. But I've never heard of anybody being murdered for releasing it.
First time caller line, you're on the air with us. Welcome to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, this is Art. How are you, Richard, Bill, and George? What a
good
pleasure, Art, to talk to you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Quick story, and then I have a question for you, Mr. Doty. I was a cadet over at the Air Force Academy, and this was just vindication after many arguments that I had with my roommate and other classmates about the existence of aliens. And one of the reasons that this came up was when we were learning about space history, one of our captains had said, hey, aliens don't exist. And then a general stood up after he said that, after he had left, and said, actually, they do. And we just all kind of chuckled. But anyway, the question I have for you, Richard, is being from New Mexico, I have always wondered, do you have an opinion as to why there has been so much activity and so much history regarding visitations and activity out in New Mexico? What is it about New Mexico? Why not anywhere else in the world?
You know, that's a good question. I don't know. I don't know that answer. I've known people have speculated that the New Mexico area is similar to that of the extraterrestrials' planet, and that they were attracted to New Mexico by the detonation of the first A-bomb back in 1945.
That makes sense. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks. I'm glad you called the program. Isn't it interesting, Richard Doty and Bill Ryan, John Kennedy's killed in 1963. This apparent trip occurs in 65. Some people have theorized that one of the reasons why he was assassinated was he was going to go public about UFOs.
Yes, I heard that. And, you know, ironically, one of the postings mentioned that they almost canceled the mission because of the death of President Kennedy, and that apparently President Johnson was briefed and gave the go ahead for it. But I think it also said in the posting that President Johnson didn't think it was going to occur.
Okay,
Bill might be able to expound on that.
Yeah, Bill?
I have absolutely no view on this at all. I have no
all
information
right.
to offer, I'm afraid.
Okay, that's fair enough. Let's go east of the Rockies. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hi. My question is for Richard.
Sure.
And I was wondering if anybody has considered the fact that there may be people that are a little more prepared to go on these trips, that they've been prepared.
Explain that a little bit more for us.
Oh,
You mean they've been trained for these trips?
No, physically changed.
Oh, physically changed, genetically altered, maybe
yes.
for endurance or something like that?
Well, I don't know how they would be changed.
Hmm.
But
anything on the postings, Bill Ryan, about that, that these 12 who went might have been changed, altered a little bit?
Absolutely nothing at all. There's not the slightest indication of that. These are ordinary flesh and blood, 100% human beings like you and me, as far as we're led to believe.
Yet there is talk that these aliens came to this planet thousands of years ago and did a little manipulation, didn't they?
There are rumors that have been circulating throughout the ufology community for decades about this. I have no information about this. I don't believe Anonymous has said anything about this that's that leads us in any direction towards being able to resolve that kind of thing. For me, it's the field of speculation, and I'm really interested in data. I'm really interested in this particular release program. If next week or the week after that our Anonymous friend discloses some information about that, then I'll have an opinion of, and until then, I don't.
What about the what didn't they, though, say that they planted a human on this planet to assist us a couple thousand years ago?
That's very true. They apparently, this is one of the incredible pieces of information that's presented in front of us. And one of the things that I pointed out, of course, is that, I mean, this is a real button for us. We start thinking now, who was this, you know, a couple of thousand years ago? It could be somebody who was unknown to history. It could have been Alexander the Great. It could have been Plato. It could have been Socrates. It could have been it might even have been Gautama Siddhartha, if their time scale was just a little stretch beyond that couple of thousand. It doesn't have to have been the person who we immediately think it was. And it's just one of those tantalizing pieces of information that we can chew on forever, but it doesn't actually help us very much until we have something definitive. And at the moment, we just don't have anything definitive.
George, did the caller, did she mean that once they came back, were they genetically altered?
I think before they left,
I see.
Were they altered in order to, I guess, endure the, you know, the 13 years
okay.
out there?
Okay.
Let's go to our West of the Rockies line. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Good evening, George, Bill, and Richard.
Hi.
Good evening.
Quick comment, you know. My friend and I saw a UFO in 1976, and to this day, we've never told anybody about it because it was such an incredible deal. So I totally believe this is possible. And my question, I have a two-part question. First of all, was there anything in the postings about how they communicated with these people? Did they actually, like, speak English or something? And then second of all, did they say anything about the planet? Was there, like, trees and oceans and wild animals on it?
Great. Thank you for that one. We're told that there were significant problems in communication, which is really interesting. There were apparently a couple of linguists on the trip, which indicates that they were expecting to have issues to do with this, which I guess is not entirely surprising. Interestingly, we're told that one of the women was a linguist, and so, you know, this particular person wasn't necessarily like a GI or a pilot, you know, that she was a linguistic specialist, so we're given to understand. But even so, it appears that there were tremendous difficulties in really understanding the alien's language. It didn't translate directly into English as far as I'm led to understand. They spoke, if spoke is the right word, in a kind of tonal sort of chanting.
All right, hold that, Bill. Let's finish that up and also talk about the animals and creatures that were on this planet when we come back, and we'll take final phone calls as well. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, on our next Coast to Coast program, as you know, John Lear once said that he believes the moon was towed into position. Well, our guests Christopher Knight and Alan Butler will talk about who built the moon. They'll be talking about whether or not the moon is artificial, hollow, and why it was engineered to sustain life on the planet. And we'll be back in a moment with our two guests, Bill Ryan and Richard Doty, and your phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Bill Ryan, Richard Doty, our guests. I'm George Norrie. We'll take your final calls. Bill, let's chat a little bit about animals and creatures that might be on that planet. Did they describe it at all?
They described some tantalizingly interesting creatures, yes. The first major creature they encountered, they described it looked like an armadillo. And this creature apparently was extremely hostile. It started to attack the team several times, and they were with an Eben guide, and this guide used some kind of a sound device, some kind of a sonic beam, to scare away this armadillo. Later on, they found a strange animal, which they nicknamed the Beast. It looked like a large ox, but this was timid. It apparently was not a hostile animal. Another creature, we're told, about was something that they nicknamed the mountain lion. Because it looked like a mountain lion, it had long fur around its neck. But apparently this was not hostile. The animal was very curious, but there was no need to take any action against this creature. And they found something that was like a large snake with a particularly large head that was 15 feet long and a foot and a half in diameter. All of these, I mean, this is extraordinarily tantalizing information. There must have been more creatures that they saw. They didn't describe so far the, you know, bird life or insect life or any fish in the water that was there. There weren't any large oceans, apparently. There are comparatively small bodies of water. And as I've said a few times before, we're only a tiny fraction of the way through the total volume of information that there must be to be released. And each of Anonymous's postings, it's kind of like on a different topic, you know, like there's one posting that's about geology, there's another posting about the team training, there's another posting about the climate, another posting about the even social customs and rituals and their language. And we're still waiting for one, I guess, that goes into more detail about the zoology and the ecology, and maybe that's to come. We invite your listeners to keep on checking the site to see what's there.
Very good. Let's go back to the phones. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, George. My name is Mark. I'm calling from South Dakota.
Hey, Mark. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Very honored to speak with you. I apologize. I missed the first part of the show, so I didn't hear how they got transported or what sort of transportation was done to get to this planet.
They got in an alien craft of which we don't know yet, nor do we know the propulsion. Hopefully, whoever's been posting on the SERPO website will start releasing that information, too.
Any other forms of transportation that they thought other than a ship?
Bill?
Okay. Well, what we know is that the journey took 9 months, so we're told. It took 9 months going, and it took 7 months coming back. For some reason, probably it was a different kind of craft. There's no reason to believe that they're all the same. Maybe some are faster than others. They took 45 tons of equipment with them, and surviving with a crew of 12 plus whatever even pilots and crew there were for 9 months, we're talking about a pretty large spaceship. And so this isn't going to be one of those flying discs that we hear so much about that might be maybe 10, 20, 30 feet in diameter. This is going to be a large interstellar craft. And we've spoken before in this show about the commonly accepted tenets of ufology, so to speak. And what is commonly accepted is that these relatively small disc-shaped craft are intra-atmospheric craft. They're not designed for interstellar flight. They don't have the wherewithal for that. They don't have a lot of room inside, so we're told. And it may well be that the interstellar craft are out there somewhere in orbit around the sun, or possibly around our planet or on the moon or somewhere. This is pure speculation. And then the smaller craft are their scout craft that just come to take a look and see what we're doing down here. But we don't know the details. We're told that on the planet Serpo itself, the local forms of transport were these little devices. They all levitated off the ground. They didn't run around in cars with wheels like we do. they had something that had some kind of capacity to hover or levitate or anti-gravitate itself off the ground and then move around that way. We're told that these little craft, they were easy to learn to fly, and within a couple of days, our team managed to master these things. They didn't have to be taxied around. They had these things at their disposal. Beyond that, we don't know anything, and we're still waiting.
And, the fact that there are only 650,000 inhabitants on that planet still boggles my mind, Bill.
That's the information we've got. And yeah. If Mr. Anonymous and his colleagues are listening to this now, which I suspect that they are, I'd like to say hello to them. I'd like to thank them for all their efforts and their courage and their integrity in coming forward with this information. You can get a feel for the sort of information which people are hungry to receive now. This is one of the questions I think that people would love to have a little bit more clarity on. If there's any possibility of hearing about it, then let's hear more. People would really appreciate that.
Bill, do you have any interaction with Anonymous?
Absolutely none.
None. Okay. If you ever do, I would be more than willing to invite him on the program with you again. And again, it would be anonymous to talk in depth about this.
I absolutely understand where you're coming from. I think this would be any radio commentator's dream Christmas gift. I do have to say that what little understanding I have of the process which is happening here, I do think this is extremely unlikely. I do not think that this group will ever make themselves known. They would be hounded. And if they are senior citizens with a lifetime of distinguished service behind them who are now trying to do their best for their country and for mankind, I don't think they're doing this for the limelight. I think they're doing this out of a sense of duty and integrity. And I don't think they want their names known. I think they want the information out.
Okay. Well, that's what I'm saying, though. I mean, I would interview him anonymously.
Well, if he's there and he's listening now, he's listening to your words, and he can get in touch through Victor Martinez and the postings that we're receiving regularly, or anyone can contact me anonymously through the Serpo contact page, and I wouldn't have a clue who it's from.
All right.
All I get is the message.
And I could take a direct email at george@coasttocoastam.com and try to get you, Bill, to verify who this individual might be in terms of maybe you pre-screening him for me in the event that he is not who he is not. Let's go to our wild card line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, my name's Diane. I'm from Minnesota.
Hi, Diane.
And I have a question for Bill.
Sure.
You kind of answered, I guess, a little bit ago when you said that our crew was able to travel on the planet. But I guess I was wondering if our crew was accepted by their society or if they had to be hidden like an alien being is hidden here if they come here. And I guess one more quick question. Is there any plans for anybody to go back or has anything like that been discovered?
Wonderful questions, Diana. Thank you very much. Apparently, we're told that they were able to travel freely. They were guests of the planet's leaders and their civilization. They had some guides with them. They had no problems traveling. They weren't kept secret, or they traveled widely. They conducted scientific experiments. They surveyed the geology and the vegetation and the ecology, as we're told. And in fact, they even traveled to another planet of the system, which is called Otto. These details are on the site, Otto, O-T-T-O. It was further out, apparently, from Serpo. There were some animals on that site, but no indigenous intelligent life. And this is where the Ebens would mine for minerals. And they did visit Otto, and they did come back. And that's all we know. And, Diana, please forgive me. I've forgotten your second question.
Let's move on, though, because we've got so many people still stacking up here. But, Richard, I did want to ask you with regards to this film, how authentic did it look to you that you saw back in 1980s?
It was quite authentic. It was a government film. It was appropriately nomenclatured, indicating it was a government film. And I was, I was in a secure area when I saw it, so it looked legitimate to me.
Okay, let's go to our wild card line. It's your turn. Hi there. Hello.
Hey, George.
Yes, sir.
Sean. Hi, truck Sean. Across Hi. Arkansas.
Good
and,
to have you with us.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead, Sean.
Oh, okay. Well, what I was wondering was, you know, that they were saying it was an exchange program. I was wondering if you could tell me that if they actually left anybody here when they went they didn't leave anybody here, when they went or whatever.
Yes, they did indeed. Let me pick this up. This was something we discussed in the earlier part of the program. Our first visitor was somebody. It was an alien being. We got to call him a person who we named EBE-1, extraterrestrial biological entity. He arrived with the Roswell crew. His other five compatriots died. He lived for 5 years until he died in June 1952, and it's through his arrival that the whole communication with his society was set up. The second visitor, EBE-2, came for 20 years, arrived in April 1964 and left in 1984. And then there were three more visitors, one of which was female, who arrived in 1978 and left in November 1994. And that was, just doing my arithmetic there, that's 16 years. Now, this isn't information that comes directly from Anonymous. These, again, are the commonly accepted tenets of UFO lore. They're pretty well established. Rick Doty may be able to comment on that, but it was genuinely an exchange program. We entertained these guys as our guests at the same time.
I wonder if they're still here. Richard Doty, what do you think?
No, I don't think they are. I knew of three, and there's supposed to be a fourth one, but I never had any knowledge of that fourth one. I knew there were three, and the third one being a female.
Was it just our country that had this kind of relationship with them, or did the former Soviet Union, China, England, did they have a relationship?
Well, we could do an entire story on an incident that occurred in China some years ago that the U.S. intelligence reported. But just a short answer, yes, apparently there was an incident in China.
Do we know if the Germans, prior to World War II, had any kind of intervention with them?
There's rumors of that, and there's a supposedly, I've never seen it, but there's supposedly a document that somebody uncovered in Hitler's in the Third Reich's files that mentioned this. But then again, it was something I've seen on the internet, and I've never seen it. Just rumors of it.
All right, let's go to our international line. Where are you calling from? Hi there.
It's John calling from Saskatchewan.
Hi, John. Go ahead, sir.
Well, I hear you guys are interested in communicating with somebody with military intelligence community. We got a little frustrated, like I'm former military intelligence, got frustrated with our system. So we approached Lieutenant General Hillier and Lloyd Axworthy directly. We've handed over some documents. We were trying to get down to Dr. Greer. And for whatever reason, every time we'd send it down, it was intercepted. He never received it. Some of the information there you'd definitely find interesting. If you've ever heard of an area called the Cold Lake Air Weapons Range, it's approximately the size of about one-third of all of Wyoming. That's definitely an area of interest for some of your researchers to start taking a look at.
I wonder if, John, just before this program closes here, would you care to email me some details on the SERPA contact form? You can do this anonymously if you wish. I'd be more than welcome to hear any information that you have to offer here. I'll be able to get it to you I'll be able to get it to the right hands.
Excellent. That's actually why I've been calling, because I'm actually getting a little frustrated trying to contact some of these people. Like, for example, Stanton Freeman, I think he just ignores me or whatever, but, yes, I definitely would like to get in touch with you and sit down over a cup of coffee, and we could go over some of this stuff.
Well, I'm not sure about the coffee, but not because I don't like coffee, but I think we're in different parts of the world. But if you want to get in touch with me, I'll do whatever I can do to get your information to the right people.
Okay.
All right, John, and you're in Canada. Were you Canadian military at the time or U.S.?
I was Canadian military for 9 years, and then I went to work for the NSA for 3 years.
Okay.
And then I had a little dispute with my handlers, and I left. I've actually called you a couple times over some interesting stuff. For example, you were curious about your doppelgangers. And I
I remember your name now.
Yeah, and I gave you the heads up as to what the heck was actually going on there.
If you'd like, we'd also put you on hold now, and you can get our mailing address if you want to send us anything at Coast to Coast.
All right.
All right, let's do that. Put him on hold, Steve, and Tommy, take it away. And we'll share information as well, Bill, if anything comes our way and vice versa. Let's stay in touch with each other on that, okay?
For sure.
Next up, not too much time left, so let's get a quick call in. We'll go to our West of the Rockies line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Okay. Hi, George. Hi, guys. A previous caller asked my question, which was going to be if they left anybody behind, so that was covered. But I did want to – maybe this can cap off the program. What do you guys, Bill and Richard, what do you think is the purpose of it all? And the reason I ask that is because when we have exchanges, like you've been calling it an exchange, between, say, high school programs, you know, just a cultural exchange, it's supposedly for the betterment of mankind and so on and so forth. But do you think they're really that interested in learning about us? We know we are about them. And can you address that a little bit?
I think they are legitimately are. If they've been monitoring us for several thousand years, they're probably checking up on us to see how we have advanced over these several thousand years. So they're just as interested in us as we are them.
And your thoughts, Bill?
Thank you. Yes. I think we have to put ourselves in the position of primitive tribesmen in some little island somewhere in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. And we're visited by these high-tech people from our Western world in America. And we, you know, with all the altruism that we have, we would probably want to help those guys. We'd want to give them a little bit of technology. We wouldn't want to wreck their civilization. We'd be very careful about what we were doing. We'd want to gently ease them into the larger community of different races, higher technology, but at the same time, we'd want to respect them, we'd want to treat them well, and we wouldn't want to give them too much of a shock. And if you look at the analogies there, there may be something very similar happening, but that's just my speculation.
All right, Bill's website is serpo.org. It's linked up with his name on coasttocoastam.com. Both of you, Bill Ryan, Richard Doty, thank you. This has got to be, for me personally, one of the most fascinating topics I've ever dealt with in my career. And let's just... stay in touch with each other, okay?
Thank you, George.
Thank you very much, George. It's been a pleasure.
This is a truly remarkable story. For Steve Carr, Dan Galanti, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesor, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. I'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.